Hello and welcome to Volume 58 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss a number of instances where timber owners have fought back against government regulation. Measure 37 in Oregon is one example, and a little closer to home, eminent domain abuse in Alabama is another. We'll also discuss a puzzling development in our own Coosa County, where the county commissioners have thumbed their nose at the county's largest industry. And we'll give you some reasons to attend the AFOA annual meeting in April, where you'll be able to meet some of the candidates for public office. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Eminent domain was a word that had little to do with most of us, that is, until a recent U.S. Supreme Court case opened the way to eminent domain abuse around the country. Now, many state legislators are fighting back and passing restrictions to eminent domain abuse. One such state is Alabama, and one such legislator is State Senator Steve French, our first guest. Welcome, Senator French.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what's going on in the Alabama legislature to help protect private property from eminent domain?
Well, we're in the middle of a filibuster right now by some that want to protect the status quo as it is now, which is to say they want to be able to take private property from anybody for any reason. And that's the danger that was allowed when the Supreme Court ruled last summer. And that's what the majority, I believe, of the Alabama legislature is going to address, and we're going to try to fix and put in protections. The rights of property owners has been one of the key and important bedrocks of American society, and we're going to step in and make sure that Alabama has a strong law that will protect property rights.
So it's the filibuster that's preventing your bill from moving forward, is that right?
Well, actually, there's a companion bill, Senator Pruitt, I shouldn't say a companion bill, but another bill by Senator Pruitt that has taken a more consensus, perhaps, approach than my bill. Mine is a little bit more aggressive, I would say.
Well, let's talk about the
Senator Pruitt bill right now, but we're trying to. He's been very helpful, I think, in trying to add some of my safeguards in my bill to his bill. So we're working to get a consensus bill.
Well, I'm sure there's several ways of approaching this, but why don't you tell our listeners what your bill does and why you think your approach is the better approach?
Well, I've been working with the Institute of Justice out of Washington, D.C., and groups here locally in Alabama, and what we're trying to do is over the years there had been a definition of blight, for instance.
Definition of blight, okay.
What we're trying to do is hem that up and make it that if you do have a crack house or an abandoned piece of property that is a danger to the community, poses a health threat or a safety threat, then you can, the government can go in with eminent domain. But you can't take eminent domain and use the blight definition for an abandoned shopping center, for instance, like is being proposed in East Birmingham right now, and just because the property owner doesn't want to keep the building up and find new tenants, you can't just do that and use eminent domain right under my bill. Right now, you can do that, and the city of Birmingham's in the process of declaring a usable retail space as a blighted area.
So it sounds like your bill goes a little bit further and is a little more detailed on attacking this one subpart of the whole eminent domain abuse issue, and that's where blight could be used to continue to abuse private property rights.
I think my definition of blight is a little bit tighter and less ripe for abuse than any other bill in the legislature right now. We're also trying to get into the subject and the arena of what happens when there is a taking of land, and how do you compensate the landowner, and how do you make it to where an unfair situation for the property owner is as fair as it can be. And so that's really the thrust of my bill. Redefine blight, control it, tighten up the language on what public use actually is, and those two issues are synonymous or linked, and then try to get into the takings part.
Okay. Well, thank you, Senator French. We appreciate you joining us.
Great. Thank you.
We will probably look back at this decade and comment that one of the largest land transactions in history took place, and we never knew about it. It's the trend of forest industry quietly selling off its land base to other private owners. Al Gertzel is a forestry consultant in Maryland and who studied this issue and trend. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us what's going on with this phenomenon of land transfers from the forest products and paper companies to private investment-oriented landowners in the U.S.
Well, there's been a sea change in forest industry ownership of forest land in the United States. In the 1980s, integrated forest products companies owned as much as 14% of all the timberland in the U.S. That amounted to some 70 million acres. But that's not the case anymore. Most of the industry timberland has changed hands to what I would call an investor-owner class of owners. Some of these are forest industry companies that have morphed into entities that are mainly timber growers, but many are entities that didn't exist 5, 10, or 20 years ago.
You mentioned the figure 14% was owned by forest industry, and that's changing now. It's going to be shrinking, isn't it?
That's correct.
What does this shift in timberland ownership mean for the private family landowner?
Well, for one thing, there are more opportunities for individuals to own forest land. Some of the large tracts of forest industry ownership has been subdivided or is in the process of being subdivided into much smaller units. So the number of private landowners is going to increase. Secondly, family forests currently contribute somewhere on the order of 60% of all the timber that's harvested in the United States, and that will probably increase. I guess the fact that so much new capital is going into timberland reinforces the fact that timber is a good investment.
Mm-hmm.
So landowners, I think, need to keep abreast of markets and understand the potential returns from their timber management activities.
Let you speculate, look in your crystal ball a little bit. Where do you think this trend is going to take us in the future?
Well, I think the trend in timberland ownership that's transferring away from forest industry to this investor-owner class is continuing, and it's not going to stop anytime soon. And I think a few years down the road, there'll be just a handful of what used to be integrated forest products companies that with own timberland as well as manufactured products. So land will continue to change hands, and I think ultimately there will be a much larger segment of the timberland that will be owned by family forest owners.
Okay, we'll have some more company then. Well, thank you, Al. I appreciate you joining us and offering that perspective.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dave Honeycutt calls in from Oregon. Hello, Dave.
How are you, Hayes?
Dave, you've been fighting government abuse of private property rights, as I understand it, with legislation, and it was legislation we discussed several years ago on this program, and it's called Measure 37. Could you describe Measure 37 again for us? And most of our listeners are not going to remember what it was about.
Well, what Measure 37 does is it says if you're a property owner, when you buy your land, the regulations that are in place on your land will be protected, and the rights that you have in your land will be protected now and 5 years from now and 10 years from now. If the government decides to change the regulations and limit what you can do with your property and lower its value, then they have to compensate you or go ahead and remove the regulations and allow you to continue to do the things that you were doing at the time that you bought the land in the first place.
Okay, so that has actually, it's actually a state law in Oregon. It's passed all the processes to become a state law. Could you tell us what role the Oregon timber industry played in passing the measure?
Well, Hayes, the small to medium-sized timber companies are really the backbone of support for property rights in Oregon. They were the primary backers of this measure. It was their help and their desire to protect their investments that led to their support for the measure, and the measure was approved throughout Oregon in 35 out of 36 of our Oregon counties. So it's been a wildly popular measure, and due in large part to small to medium-sized timber companies.
Could you translate this to forest landowners, how you think it changes the landscape or assists them in managing their forest land?
Well, Oregon has a highly regulatory state. We've got this, the only statewide centralized land use planning system in the United States, and so the timber industry has really been hit hard in Oregon by over-regulation, particularly at the state level, but also with a couple of Endangered Species Act listings at the federal level. This measure will guarantee that when somebody makes an investment in forest land, that the rights that they have and the investment that they make is going to be protected from over-regulation. And so it's a real boon to all property owners in Oregon, but particularly the timber industry, which is such a large part of our economy.
And what about other states? Are other states watching what's going on in Oregon and making changes in their own state laws?
Absolutely. Well, the Wisconsin legislature is working on a Measure 37. It should pass and be up to the governor's desk in the next couple of weeks. South Carolina is working on it. Montana, Arizona, Missouri, Michigan. It's taken hold. We're moving across the country.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave. Appreciate you joining us. Well, the states that Dave mentioned, Wisconsin, South Carolina, Montana, Arizona, and Michigan, are bucking the trend that our own Coosa County, Alabama, County Commission is following. You may not be aware of this, but Coosa County, Alabama is positioning itself to the left of the state of California, at least when it comes to putting bureaucracy in front of cutting your own timber. The Coosa County Commission has done what no other county in Alabama has done, and that's passed a rule requiring a permit to cut your trees. Doug McConnell is a forestry consultant and landowner in Coosa County who rung the bell warning us of this rather odd way of treating your biggest and perhaps only industry. Hello, Doug.
Good morning, Hayes.
What can you tell other landowners in Alabama about this resolution?
Well, the resolution is a bit misguided in that it states as its purpose to improve and maintain roadways in the county, yet it, within the resolution, makes no statement toward the roadways. Unfortunately, the commissioners have mistaken knowing who is doing the logging and which square mile of Coosa County this harvest operation is located in with a constructive relationship with our major industry in this county. Regrettably, they say they've worked 2 years on this and have not produced anything that's constructive for private landowners or this industry in our county.
It sounds like it's a rather blanket approach rather than trying to attack the specific problem that they're after.
Yes, very much so. They want names and addresses of all parties involved, including the landowner, timber purchaser, harvest contractor, hauling contractor, so that they can send the county engineer or the county engineer's personnel out to periodically monitor a timber harvest. However, I see this as generating a great deal of liability for the county itself because the personnel they're requiring by this resolution to go out to logging sites are not trained to know the hazards or dangers around a large-scale logging operation. They would have received no professional logger management training in order to know what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Well, on balance, do you think this is a positive thing or a negative thing for the county?
I believe it gives us a bit of a black eye because some timber purchasers, and Coosa County only has two actual timber processing facilities within the county. The majority of the material goes out of county.
Mm-hmm.
If a timber purchaser in any way sees the act of buying a tract of timber as too much of a difficulty and they reduce by any fraction their activities in the county, then landowners are receiving less value for their timber because of a decrease in competition. And overall, the county may see a reduction in the severance tax that they use for their rural volunteer fire departments.
So all other things being equal, if you buy timber in Coosa County, you have other hoops to jump through that you don't have in neighboring counties.
This is correct. Actually, Clay County did have or does have on the books a logging permit requirement, but their commission, it's not really enforced, as we understand from the county engineer, and also their commission does not take an antagonistic view toward the timber industry in that county.
Well, those are some comparisons. Guy, give us one quick idea of what the motivation was for the county, what was behind having this considered a problem, and how were they what were they trying to attack?
I believe they were trying to address concerns about mud being pulled out onto a road or empty trailers being dollied down on the road right-of-way on narrow or poorly maintained county roads. And a few constituents who the two commissioners who pushed this through caught their ear and raised Cain.
Okay. Well, thanks, Doug. We appreciate you alerting us to that development. We appreciate it very much.
And thank you for your questions.
The law of unintended consequences tells us that our actions may accomplish one thing that we want, but also accomplish one thing we don't want. And we've recently learned of a lawsuit against a landowner who tried to manage his deer herd by supplemental feeding, only to be sued when a deer crossed the public road and collided with a car. That's just one example of doing one thing and getting another. Bill Gray is with us, and he's a wildlife biologist. Hello, Bill.
Hey, how are you this morning?
Bill, I believe your wife had a baby yesterday. Thanks for joining us anyway. Congratulations to you.
Well, thank you.
What kind of management activities can landowners do that might cause legal problems or unintended consequences that they might not otherwise be considering?
Well, certainly you alluded to the lawsuit, and that was in December of 2004 over in Georgia, around Albany, Georgia, and the family of a man who was killed in a car collision with a deer, sued an individual that was operating a feeder in a pecan orchard. And long story short, they brought in several deer biologists and other experts, and their opinion was that, that this was a natural deer crossing anyway. Yet, the insurance company settled with the family out of court for $100,000, which there was no precedent set in favor of interest that would, you know, be able to land on. There was also no precedent set for landowners. And in my opinion, the settlement just kind of is a crack in the dam for those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly operating any kind of feeder around a public roadway is something that you would want to take a second look at. And then, you know, of course, if that ever is revisited, and it certainly could be, then, you know, you're on a slippery slope, and if you planted a food plot or whatever, it could be said to attract deer across a public thoroughfare and pose some danger to public health, you know, then, you know, all those things will have to be given a second look.
Where does the landowner go to find information about what are safe practices for managing deer herd and other wildlife?
Well, of course, the state of Alabama, Department of Conservation, Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, with whom I'm employed, has a biologist scattered across the state that can provide help. Universities, Mississippi State, Auburn University, Georgia, right here in close proximity, they turn out lots and lots of good information. You know, I would be leery of going to sources that are trying to sell you a particular product or idea or concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those people have a vested interest in shaping what you think and what you purchase and with regards to managing wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
Universities and state agencies, and there are a lot of good private consultants out there, too.
Well, that sounds reasonable. How would you advise a landowner that wants to practice, you know, safe management and also avoid trouble, generally speaking? What would you tell them?
Gosh, that's a kind of a very broad question.
Pretty broad question, isn't it?
Well, certainly there's no downside to managing a population for, you know, a proper deer density on your property, not allowing there to be too many deer. There's no downside to that. with issues like planting slots and supplemental feeding. You have to be careful, again, that you don't locate those types of activities in areas that could lead to problems like we saw in
mm-hmm.
Georgia. As far as, you know, the legal aspects of things. Of course, there's wetland issues and some things like that I'm not that well versed in that will always have to be examined. But just in general, you kind of have to look at what you do and how it affects what's going on around your neighbors or the public. And you may have to restrict or move certain activities to different parts of your property or do away with them altogether if liability is a big concern with you.
Okay, well, those are some good tips. Thank you, Bill. Appreciate you joining us.
Uh-huh.
Alan Curtis is a retired forester, also from Oregon, who's co-authored a book on collecting wood from your property and displaying it. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
Yeah, if you're a landowner and you wanted to start a wood collection with samples of wood that's actually found on your property, how do you think you should go about doing that?
Well, walk through the property, take a look at the trees that you know, and recognize their bark features, their leaves, the flowers, and the fruit, and then get a book, a good book, a basic book on tree identification, and walk through your property again and put names on some of the other trees that you haven't known before. Then I pack a little pruning saw with me, and when I find a wind-thrown tree or a broken limb on the ground, I'll cut a piece of it and take it back. And in time, I cut these pieces to a uniform size and put a name on them. It can be written on with a ballpoint pen or a label printed on a computer. And so you're getting a small group of different woods together from your own trees. But don't just limit it to your own property. If they're clearing land for a golf course nearby or a highway, step out onto that land, ask permission, and see if you can find some other kinds of trees that have been cut so that you can take a specimen from those as well.
When you're putting together a collection, what features are you trying to highlight with wood? Are you looking at the grain or the most people have seen leaf collections and so forth, but what do you think should be displayed?
With wood, one of the most attractive features, of course, is its color. Walnut being brown, honey locust being a pinkish red color, holly white, pawpaw green, red cedar, reddish, and you want to feature the colors. But I also like to feature a cross-section of the tree, of the log there, maybe 3, 4, 6 inches in diameter, and that way it'll show the heartwood, which is the dark, more attractive color, and the sapwood, which is the lighter outer portion. And occasionally there'll be some figure in the wood, such as a tiger stripe that sometimes appears in maples. And with a longitudinal section, you can show that feature very well.
Give us some tips on displaying and storing the collection that you put together.
Several things can be done. If you make specimens or samples, as I do, which are 6 inches long, 3 inches wide, half an inch thick, you can stand them up on a bookshelf and put a label, of course, in each one, and it becomes your reference library of different kinds of woods. Or if you're a wood worker, such as a wood turner, you can make bowls or plates or vases from the different pieces that you've collected and display them on a table. Some people like to mount their cross sections in a picture frame and hang them on the wall. There's just endless possibilities. Other collections are in the form of eggs. I know one man who has close to 1,000 eggs that he's turned, each from a different wood. Of course, not all from his own property, but from woods he's collected.
Okay.
And people like to carve boots, and there's just endless possibilities.
All right. We appreciate it, Alan. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Henry Barclay is a CPA and is a past president of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and we wanted to talk with him about a tax topic called income averaging. Hello, Henry.
Hey there, Hayes. How you doing today?
Can you tell us about income averaging and why it's important to forest landowners and how it works?
Income averaging is essentially, as it's configured now, the idea that I take some or all of my income that I have this year and, in essence, spread it over this year and some prior years and recompute my tax. What it does is it lowers the incremental tax rate. And right now, it can only be used for farmers and fishermen.
Okay. Has anything changed in income averaging over the past years?
Well, it has. Back before 1986, we could generally income average. Anybody could income average. If you had a spike in your income, you could go back and income average. In 1986, President Reagan's Reform Act, we now date the Internal Revenue Code from 1986 because the changes were so dramatic, eliminated, among other things, income averaging, which was then reinstated in 1997 for farmers and fishermen. Now, for this purpose, timber farmers are not, quote, farmers.
Okay, so it was eliminated and now it's back in some way?
That's correct.
So it now applies to the forest landowners?
Doesn't apply to forest landowners, and that's what the Forest Landowners Tax Council is working on at this moment, is to try to have this applied to timber owners. And here's what would essentially happen. Right now we have two rates for capital gains tax. One is 15%, which is the normal rate, and the other is 5%, which is the rate if you have taxable income between zero and, say, about $60,000. So if I have tax in that lower taxable income type bracket, I'm only going to pay 5%. Well, let's just suppose that my wife and I file a joint tax return and that for each of the last 3 years and for this year, I have normal income of about $30,000. And let's just say that in 2005, we made the first sale that we made in 20 years. This is not uncommon, as you know.
First sale of timber, right.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. that we have a gain of $120,000. Now, that looks pretty big, but I haven't made a sale for 20 years, Hayes. So, before our sale, our Alabama and federal tax would be $5,400. But if I put all of that sale in this year, I'm going to owe $27,100 for it. But if I get to average, just like farmers and fishermen can average, then I would only pay $17,100 or I'd save about $10,000. So this is a dramatic difference.
All right, well, that's how income averaging works. Who's working on getting that reinstated for timber owners?
Right now the Forest Landowners Tax Council is working on that.
And tell us about that group.
The Forest Landowners Tax Council is a group of folks that, in fact, they're really the only group that represents the non-industrial private forest landowner. There are a lot of groups that represent folks in industry, but there's nobody that really speaks for the non-industrial private forest landowner, folks like you and me. And so we look at issues across the board in the Forest Landowners Tax Council, and we're looking for issues that would help individual landowners in growing their timber and getting treated fairly, particularly from the standpoint of their tax consequences.
Okay. Well, good luck to you, Henry, on that endeavor. We appreciate it. We've invited John McMillan, who's the former executive vice president of the Alabama Forestry Association, to discuss a topic that's of interest to the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and that's its annual meeting in Montgomery on April the 28th and 29th. Hello, John.
How you doing this morning?
Tell us if a landowner attended this meeting, what they might expect to see.
Well, it's going to be a good opportunity for landowners to get a better feel for how the business of Montgomery operates. It's also going to be a good chance to mix and mingle with candidates and incumbents for a legislative and statewide office to discuss issues with them that affect us as landowners.
Mm-hmm.
It's also going to be a good opportunity to visit with various government agencies and independent groups that influence decision-making in Montgomery that affects landowners, as well as the opportunity to tour the Capitol complex.
Well, that sounds like a full plate, and you mentioned several things, one being the legislators that might be there and the visit to the state capitol. But I wanted to ask you about the groups that also influence Montgomery in decision-making. Who are those groups, and who might landowners come in contact if they came to this meeting?
Well, the Alabama Forestry Commission is certainly an important agency and organization that provides professional technical assistance to landowners and help us with our forest management decisions. And then the Alabama Forestry Association is a diverse group that represents all sectors of the forestry community, particularly in the area of governmental affairs and educating the public on forestry issues. Then the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources is another very important agency that's responsible for the management of almost all Alabama state lands, including the forever wild properties. They also are responsible for creating and enforcing the rules and regulations and other wildlife and fisheries management issues that affect landowners. So all these groups will be presenting us with some technical and informational sessions that will be of great interest to landowners.
If you had to highlight one thing that's really a must-see, what would you single out?
I think the Friday evening opportunity to meet and greet candidates is where landowners will really have a chance to get up and close and personal with candidates to discuss their individual or collective interest. And in addition to that, it's a mighty good bargain at $10 to be able to have face-to-face opportunities with these kind of folks and also enjoy some mighty good food.
Well, John, you've recently left the Alabama Forestry Association in good hands with Chris Isaacson, but I wanted to ask you about you. What's next for you?
Well, Hayes, I've made a decision to go ahead and retire from the Forestry Association a little bit earlier than I had initial planned to go down and run for the Senate seat in District 22, which is all a part of 8 counties in southwest Alabama. It's certainly the most heavily forested area of our state and also a very rural area for the most part. So I'm really looking forward to this opportunity.
If listeners are not familiar with what District 22 encompasses, what counties are included in that district?
It's a part of Baldwin, all of Escambia, part of Conecuh, part of Monroe, part of Choctaw, almost all of Clark, all of Washington, and the extreme north and east portions of Mobile County.
Okay, quite a wide range there.
Very large geographic area.
All right, well, we wish you luck on that race. We appreciate you joining us, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and I hope you have a great meeting.
And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Steve French, Al Gertzel, Dave Honeycutt, and Doug McConnell. And we also appreciate the contributions of Bill Gray, Alan Curtis, Henry Barclay, and John McMillan. Here's a recipe for running a county government. Find your largest and, let's face it, the only industry in your county and begin to make it harder for it to do business. That's what the current Coosa County commissioners have done for the forest industry. I say current because they are elected officials. They've chosen to pass a resolution regulating the harvesting of timber. Timber located in a county which needs to support its industry, not punish it. If they're right and these type of resolutions take hold, maybe your county is next. Maybe you'll get the chance to go down to your county courthouse and ask your county commissioners for permission to cut your own timber. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.